Hey everybody, this is Pete Worrell from Bigelow, and I'm welcoming you to this episode of the Positive Enterprise Value Podcast. You ever notice that some private enterprises successfully transition through evolutions and revolutions in leadership, management, even ownership? Some end up with a terrific new majority partners, the entrepreneur, owner, managers moving gracefully into the next interesting and rewarding chapter of their lives, surrounded by friends, their positive legacy assured, their independence powered by the fortune they just realized. While others' outcomes can look more like a train wreck. Is it luck or is it more than luck? At Bigelow, we think it's more than luck. For over 30 years, I've had the fun of meeting with thousands of seasoned, successful private business owners and working closely with hundreds of them. In this podcast, I interview some of the most high-performing, successful entrepreneur owner managers from both the for-profit and the not-for-profit domains. Today, I'm going to share with you my podcast interview with Kyle Regan. Kyle is the president and CEO of a company called DECCO, D-E-C-C-O, which is a mechanical contractor that specializes in the most complex capital projects for pharmaceutical companies. Kyle came from a working class background, was a great high school baseball player, and in fact got drafted by professional baseball teams. He worked with the Cincinnati Reds organization and with the Atlanta Braves organizations as a catcher. And he persuaded them, with the help of his mom, to pay for college in between the season years. And so as he was being a professional baseball catcher, he also was going to college and getting a degree in construction management. As he transitioned out of the professional baseball world, he realized that he really wanted to work with people where he could help them unlock their potential, particularly people who didn't have much. And he began work at a company called DECCO as a project engineer. The former owner of DECCO had a succession plan, and Kyle found himself a part of it. The business grew and transformed from being basically a company that provided complex mechanical piping electrical solutions for semiconductor manufacturers, to one where Kyle began to smooth the strategy and pivot towards pharmaceutical manufacturers. With a lifelong focus, as I mentioned, on unlocking the potential in others, Kyle views part of his role as a facilitator to helping even the most junior workers at DECCO begin to have a life where they could feel appreciated and valued in their work life, which would spill over into their personal life. Kyle's work with DECCO has recently culminated in its acquisition by Comfort Systems, a strategic investor, a public company, where DECCO is now wholly owned. I had the fun of interviewing Kyle in his offices in January 2024. And I bet you're going to learn a lot and enjoy it just as I did. So let me ask you, Kyle, there's a bunch of ground I'd like to cover with you, but one of the things I want to talk about is, and you've already brought it up, is like, in a way, you're entering a new chapter in life. Right, for you, mm-hmm. the company, but also your family. What chapter is it?
You know, it's interesting because I sort of danced around this when I was talking about it earlier. Maybe 8 times out of 10, this would be near the, not the final chapter, that sounds pretty doomsday-ish, but near the end of the book, right? And I don't feel that way at all. It actually goes back to when this entire process for me started. One of my attorneys said, we're just having a meeting at dinner. He said, so what are you going to do with this? And I said, you know, nobody's ever asked me that, because when you're running a business, you just run the business, and then things happen. A pandemic, it gets hot out, it gets cold out, it gets hot out, it gets cold out, it gets hot out, it gets cold. And next thing you know, you've been doing it for X number of years, and you never give thought to, what are you going to do with this? I have kids in the business now, nephews in the business. And I had some conversations with those folks just around, once I started to think about what am I going to do with this, and they all said, I really don't want to do what you do. And I said, I appreciate that. The point being, they're in the company, they like working in the company, but, you know, they don't necessarily want to be here at 5 a.m. and leaving at 6 p.m. So then we started another path, and that's when we engaged with Bigelow. I ended up going to the forum 2 years ago, and for the first time in my adult life, understood what a next chapter could look like and how this might work. Because the first question was, well, who are you going to sell the company to? And I said, that was so personal. It's like, well, who are you going to give your kid to? You know, it's like, you just get, you know, you get attached to the people and the company and the process and everything that surrounds running a business. And when somebody says, well, how are you going to get rid of all that? It's like, it's a very personal thing. Yeah. But then at the forum, talking to a few of those people, you understood, wait, there are other options of how to do this and the possibility of staying in the business and staying involved and you know, taking some of the risk off the table and all the benefits of it, but also all the sort of the post-transaction existence. What does that look like and feel like? And as I said, it looks and feels kind of the same. You know, it closed on a Friday, whatever it was, but on Monday,
yeah,
it was the same.
Yeah.
And that was good. You know, that's one of the things I was worried about, was what's the next day going to feel like? And I think to a lot of people's credit, Bigelow and actually the whole team we put together, we found the right partner.
Yeah.
And I, you know, when you're staring at the ceiling fan at night
during
the process, there's always doubt, you know. Up to almost near the end of this whole process, I had thoughts about saying, let's just forget this.
Yeah.
I just want to go back to running Deco. It takes a long time. It was 6-9 months, maybe a year in this whole process.
Yeah.
I just want to go back to just being a contractor.
Simplicity.
Again. Yeah. It's so much easier just being a contractor. These dinners and all this stuff was... It was exhausting for the time period. It was well worth it, but it was, you know, going through it, you know, up until, like I said, the last couple of weeks, I said, you know what, I'm just going to call this. We'll revisit this at another time down the road.
Yeah.
Had some of those conversations with Warren, just saying, you know, because there are some things at the very end with Comfort and with Deco and some of the, you know, the cap table stuff. And it was stuff I knew we were going to work through, but it was to the point where I said, I don't know. I think I just want to go back to, you know, my wick is running short on this stuff. But thankfully, we chugged through. So that's a really long answer to the question about what chapter you're in. And I'd say I'm right in the middle of it, because now I'm at the point of, you know, first few chapters were, and I hate to fast forward through 40 years of my life, but my professional life was getting control of the company, building the company, get it through a pandemic, transacting, and then making sure it's in a really good place, because I've got family members and, you know, real family members, and then the Deco family members that are here that I want to make sure are all on really good, solid ground until I go do something else. That something else is TBD. I really don't know. I know I still like the adrenaline of sort of entrepreneurship and those ideas that just kind of keep grinding around.
Can we go back a couple of chapters?
Sure.
Because one of the things I'm really interested in is, if I understand you, would you say that you always were an entrepreneur?
No.
Okay. And so tell me about that.
Not at all.
Were your parents small business owners or entrepreneurs?
Nope. My parents were union teachers. My grandfather on my father's side was. He opened a hotel in New London, Connecticut. And I only knew this story. I knew him, but I was a baby, and he was just like the old guy in the room. He was my dad's dad, so I knew who he was in the family structure, but didn't know him on a personal level. And then I guess, you know, he passed when I was in high school, because I remember he used to go to some of my baseball, basketball games. But again, he was the old guy, and, you know, unfortunately, I didn't know him as well as, you know, I would have liked to. But I learned a lot about him in a weird sort of Irish way. I was in a bar in New London, Connecticut, which is across the street from the hotel he had opened. It was called the Crocker House in New London, Connecticut. And this was in 40s, 50s. My father grew up, and his brothers and sisters grew up in the Crocker House, trying to make it all work. And he was grandfather was the owner. And then there was a lot of, you know, race riots in New London, and New London had a real bad turn. The economy really crashed in the area. And I never knew any of this. I just knew he was Papa, right? And then I was in a bar with my brothers, I'm really close with, and a good friend of ours. And we were at a bar across the street from where the Crocker House still stands. It's something else now, at a place called Dutch's Tavern. And we're talking to the bartender, who was this old salt. And if you're in this bar after midnight, which we were, you're either lost or somewhere you probably don't want to be, but we happen to be in there. And we're talking to this guy, and he's just a really nice fella. And we had mentioned, William T. Regan used to own the Crocker House. He goes, "So who are you guys to William T. Regan?" I said, "Well, we're grandkids." And he goes on to tell us this story about when the hotel was failing. And I have no idea how he got into the hotel business or how he acquired it, how he started. But he said when the hotel was failing, he was, using a lot of his friends. He was just that kind of guy for suppliers of his restaurant and all the different services in the hotel. And then it failed. And somebody had come to him and said, and this guy was one of them. He was a supplier. Had gone to my grandfather and said, "Well, you can just file bankruptcy and then all this debt goes away." And he wouldn't do it. Mm-hmm. He said, "No." And this guy said he paid back every nickel to every person he owed money to. Never had a ton of money. I remember that.
Right. Fun for you guys to hear the story.
Oh, yeah. Way after the fact, right?
Yeah.
But to his credit, he paid off every debt. And this bartender said, "You guys are drinking free tonight." So,
oh, cool.
It took 40 years, but we said, wow, finally paid off. So that was the only entrepreneur aware of in the family.
Where did you grow up?
In East Lyme, Connecticut.
Right. So as you got out of like high school, you mm-hmm. weren't thinking to yourself, "I'm going to be an entrepreneur." What were you thinking to yourself?
I was going to be the catcher for the New York Yankees.
Perfect.
So I got drafted by the Cincinnati Reds out of high school, and I was just going to play baseball, and that was it. In fact, I had a scholarship to go to UConn to play baseball, and then the Reds drafted me. So I said, and they showed up at the house. It was completely unexpected. From today's world, it's completely unexpected. But they just said, "Okay, we drafted you in the 13th, 15th, or 18th round of the draft." I said, "Oh my God, that's fantastic." I said, "Yeah, I'll sign." So that at the time, the scout just showed up with a contract, and my mother said, "Wait a minute." So my mother was my first agent. She said,
"That's great.
You have a scholarship to go to UConn. Like, if you sign for this signing bonus, what about school?"
Yeah.
And I said, "School? I don't have to go to school. I'm going to play professional baseball." And thank God she was in the room. So the scout left, went back to the Reds, came back with a scholarship where they'd pay for my school whenever I was done. And I said, "Now can I, Mom, now can I sign?" She said, "Yeah, now you can sign." So I signed. I went and played baseball. Played 3 years. Played with the Reds and the Braves. Had some injuries along the way. But when I was done playing, I was kind of taking classes during the winter when I could. But still, half-heartedly, I was just taking classes because Mom said I had to.
You were still single.
Still single, yep. And then I got out of baseball, and I said, "You know what? I'm kind of done with baseball. I'm tired of this. I don't want to go back to the Braves and be a bullpen catcher and do these things. I'm ready to kind of go back and hang out with my brothers and start that chapter." So I got out and went home. My mother said, "Well, you're going to college, just so you know." And I had been taking classes at UConn along the way. Transferred to Fitchburg State College, my credits, because they had a construction program. And even at that time, I'm 20-something. I had no idea what I wanted to do, but I said, "Construction. I like construction. Seems neat to me." So went to Fitchburg State in their construction management program. Finished school there, and that's where I met Roy Greenwald, who was the original, the secondary owner of Deco.
How did you meet him?
I was the the student chapter president of Associated Builders and Contractors Group.
Yeah.
And he was the chairman of Associated Builders and Contractors of Massachusetts.
Oh, yeah.
And we were doing some things together through the student chapter. And he said, now I was married, my wife Heather. And he said, oh, when you're done at school, you should come work for us. We're in Brookline. I said, oh, it's Brookline. That's great. We're living in Watertown, Mass. That's right across the Mass Pike. He said, no, we're in Brookline, New Hampshire. and I said, what everybody says, where the hell is Brookline, New Hampshire?
And was he a generation older?
He was, yeah.
Yeah.
So he had...
Was he the founder of the business?
He was not, no. Yeah. No, Bill Donovan was the founder of the business.
Right, Donovan Equipment,
in 1934,
something like that,
no,
right?
It was William T. Donovan Company.
Okay.
That was in 1934. They were doing coal handling systems.
Yes.
Cutting edge technology at the time. He had a way of moving coal such that it wouldn't fracture it. And all the cities said, we want this technology. So that was his original plan. Roy Greenwald's father, Bud Greenwald, purchased William T. Donovan Company. Roy Greenwald's dad was running Hart Engineering at the time. So purchased William T. Donovan as a coal handling subdivision. William T. Donovan retired in the late 40s, early 50s. Hart just decided to keep William T. Donovan Company as a dormant division that wasn't active. Roy graduated college, came back, needed something to do. His father said, well, I have this William T. Donovan Company thing if you want to see what you can make of this. And we got a place up in Brookline, New Hampshire, if you want to.
And what were they doing in Brookline?
At this facility was nothing. So Roy took it up there and said, let's get into mechanical piping, which was Hart was doing.
Yeah.
Hart's a union organization. But you know, Roy said, I'm going to start a merit shop. I'm going to turn William Dunham into a merit shop mechanical contractor in Brookline, New Hampshire. And they were doing power plants. You know, that was the first sort of jobs. And the history is pretty long and rich. And that was 1984. I came on in 93.
And DECO. And Roy was hands-on with the company at that point.
Yeah, he was the owner. And then he for a few years, he was, I mean, not a few years later, now fast forward to 2003, he was trying to figure out his own path out of the company. Somebody asked him the question, what are you going to do with this?
Yes.
So he was looking internally. Had a couple failed experiments with some folks that he was trying to transition the company to, and I wasn't privy to or aware of how that would have worked in terms of stock, but it didn't work out. Eventually, Roy came to another group of us, myself, Kevin Shield, Tim Barton, Bob Stewart, Dan Tosse, John Heffernan, and said, here's how our earnings going to work, and after 5 years, if you hit all these metrics, then you're going to own the company. And all of us were in the position of, I don't really understand this, but seems cool, and I get to work here, right? So we began this journey, this five-year journey, this earn it. John Heffernan left along the way. Dan Tosse left. Bob Stewart retired.
How old were you when this happened?
So that was, I was probably mid-30s, mid to late 30s.
Yeah. And
I can tell you exactly.
Were you beginning to see yourself as, I could be the owner?
No, not yet. So that I was just getting to that part. So I'm like, I have no idea how to run this. You know, I was running one of the business units within the company. So I understood enough about financials. But to run a business seemed overwhelming. But I had this group of friends that was in this with us. I said, we'll figure this out. And we always had the tact of, we get to work here, and if this all works out, we will eventually own it. Essentially, that was it. And it did work out. There was a lot of real challenges along the way. 2009, the Great Recession hit, and we said, my God, what do we what do we do this for? But we got through every single one of them, and we all learned along the way. Some people left along the way. Eventually, it was Kevin, Tim, and I. They were older than me. They were both 10 years older than me, plus or minus.
Yep.
Always understood, you know, once we were done and this earn-in was complete, you know, we'd start looking at how they're going to sort of phase out. Tim was going to go first. Kevin was going to go second. And then there were some health issues along the way. Those two had to sort of switch orders where we'd let Kevin kind of go first and Tim go second. And then that was 2019.
And did you three have the business split up into functional areas that you ran a certain area, Tim ran a certain area? How did that
yeah,
work?
So Tim was kind of the admin guy. He had HR and safety and QC. Kevin, who was the president, sort of oversaw everything, but was really focused on large projects. That was his thing. And then I ran the service group at the time. So Kevin and I were in the two operational groups, and then Tim was sort of the umbrella. So like I said, so now fast forward to 2019, some health issues between those two changed the dynamic a bit. And then COVID hit, and we said, oof, what the hell is this? So, you know, we got through it probably the way everybody got through it every single day. You know, decisions made at 8 a.m. were ridiculous by noon and were a great idea again by 4 p.m. And that went on for months and months. We got through it. And at this point, Kevin and Tim were already really kind of semi-retired. Tim was spending time in Florida, the winter in Florida. Kevin was not engaged in the business because of his health issues. Was still on the board. But yeah, they were both involved to the level of calling me saying, well, what are we going to do? And I said, what are we going to do? You're probably body surfing at 10 o'clock and you're probably doing this, but here's what Deco's doing. And then sadly, we lost Tim. He, you know, massive heart or head issue. Mm-hmm. You know, he died.
Yeah.
And then.
Which was the wrong order. We thought it was going to be the other way.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. And then. A year, 2 years later, Kevin, same thing.
Yeah.
Lost him as well. So, you know, they were out of the business. The business was functioning. I had sort of taken it over.
So
they were
you,
still involved.
Are you like the accidental entrepreneur?
No, that's, it's funny. The, yeah, probably. Only with the experience, not a learned experience, but with the understood experience of what my grandfather did.
Yeah.
You know, he was sort of the original. So, and if I could, you know, spend 2 hours with him, I'd say, why did you start a hotel? Like, yeah. what was the voice in your head that you thought a hotel was a good idea? And how'd the business run? And really hear firsthand those stories.
Well, Kyle, because, probably because he would want to know why you did what you did, too. Yeah, why did you think this was a good idea?
Well, my parents, my father's gone now, but my mother's, she's always kind of amazed about how did you end up? Because I was the baseball player. My brother's... You know, one went to WPI. He works at Harvard. He's an executive director at Harvard on the EH&S side. My other brother was a labor attorney at Cigna. And I was the baseball player. You know, I was sort of the black sheep growing up.
Yeah.
So I just saw this week at her 80th birthday. And she asked that question. She goes, man, I mean, it's just amazing how it all sort of plays out. You know, we all did very well. But she probably had many sleepless nights worrying about where I was going to end up.
So, when you were working for Roy, and by the way, we talked about Kevin and Tim, but did you guys, you use the term earn in. So, is that in that process, did you buy out Roy?
Yeah.
And was that worked out great? Was it a happy event?
Worked out, happy event.
Happy for Roy,
too? Happy event, happy for us, happy for Roy.
And so, you were really an employee at that point.
All good, right.
Were you a good employee?
Yes. Yeah.
What makes a good employee?
Made a ton of mistakes, but a good employee. Monday was my favorite day, and
yeah,
Friday was my least favorite
day.
So
you had a lot of passion.
Really,
for
just
it.
Went above and beyond. I mean, Deco, and you know, I had well.
And look, you were a baseball player, so why did you have passion for Deco?
Other than my baseball career, Deco was my only employer. And it's interesting you ask that question because I've gotten that question a lot, and I know the answer. And I love telling a story. Grew up a baseball player, grew up in a clubhouse, grew up in a locker room, a basketball player as well, in a locker room and a clubhouse. And that environment, the team sport environment, everything that goes along with that. And when I came on board with Deco, it was interesting. My first job was at Portsmouth Naval Shipyard and went to a construction trailer. The superintendent was a, I don't know, he seemed like he was 150 years old, but right. He was probably my age at the time. And the project manager, and I started at this construction trailer, and the interactions were immediately, I said, it was within a week or maybe a month, I might be fast forwarding, I knew, I said, this feels exactly like being in a clubhouse. And what DECO was doing at the time, we were a targeted contractor. We were a merit shop. We worked in heavy union areas. You know, the DECO, we call them DECO Rangers. You know, it was a tight-knit group, pretty galvanized against sort of those outside forces. And, you know, that sort of camaraderie and that sort of teamwork that required, you know, a construction site has a third base coach. It has a manager. You know, it has an offense and a defense. It has all those sort of elements. And, you know, I knew right away in that construction environment, that particular, you know, heavy industrial construction environment, this is like sports. This felt very comfortable to me. And, you know, the folks I was interacting with and dealing with on a daily basis, they were like me. And it all really clicked right away. So that's when I knew right away, this is, you know, I knew I wanted to do construction. I thought I wanted to do construction. That first week, I knew I'm in the right spot. Cool. This is going to be great because this feels like a clubhouse. Yeah.
So,
which is why I think I was a good employee. Now, I was not an employee without making mistakes. I tell some of the project engineers around here now, it's, you know, you do this for 30 years. You make mistakes. Well, I probably made a mistake this morning, but
yeah,
I'm pretty certain I did. I'm not sure what it was. I'll figure that out later. But my first job as a project engineer, I forgot to order valves for a project.
It's a small issue.
Yeah. And, you know, these are 10-week delivery valves, and fast forward 10 weeks. Whoops. Where are the valves? I said, what valves? And I remember Roy coming in, and he made the point. He said, you know, we could have sent you to grad school. It would have cost us $100,000. Consider this mistake your grad school degree. I said, I appreciate that. Because I wore it personally. You know, it felt. So I think he knew how invested I was. I didn't just put my feet on the desk and say, well, listen, you win some, lose some. So he felt that, and I think that was just part of my commitment to what we were doing. And again, I was trying to be part of that team, and my job on that team was to order valves, and I didn't do it. I said, guys, I screwed this up.
Were you surprised as you became a business owner? Were you surprised with some of the different responsibilities or things, topics you thought about or worried about as a business owner compared to being an employee?
Not really. I have been since. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think going through the transaction really brought it to a head, because I was in a good team, you know, ownership team, and then they were peeled off, and I was so just embroiled in the ops. And I think, you know, in the construction world, we said, if you have construction work, projects to do, it covers a lot of sins. And we were so, you know, we were really busy. And when the pandemic hit, we're doing the vaccines for Moderna and for Pfizer and for Lonza, and everything was coming at us. And the focus was just on just run the business really well, and let's see what happens. And, you know, it was almost like playing a game without looking at the scoreboard. I never really looked at the scoreboard. I just knew, you know, the CFO would say, things are good. Okay, things are good. I don't want to understand why they're good. I mean, I knew why they were good, but I didn't need the details. and I think that all changed. And then we started this transaction, interacting with people, and they were asking, well, what these different metrics and these financial metrics, especially we started talking to some private equity folks, and they were preparing spreadsheets on DECO, and I was looking at them saying, this is DECO?
Yeah.
I don't even know what I'm looking at, but it seems like you know this company better than I do, which wasn't the case, but it was always interesting, the stuff that I never worried about that during the transaction I was asked about. And I didn't want to say, I don't worry about that, because they would say, you don't worry about that.
Yeah.
What the hell are you worried about? Instincts go a long way.
So you just made the metaphor that when you were at the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard, you realized this is like a game. It's kind of like a clubhouse. And you have spent a lot of time on teams. And I might argue that when you come in this beautiful building, it feels like a very much of a team environment, the things on the walls, the people, the way they greet you. Are you more satisfied to be a member of the team or to be the leader of the team?
Well, I don't know if you saw our core values that were listed on the wall.
I did. I can't say I memorized them all, but I saw that you had them on the
you
wall.
You failed. Yes. So it's commitment, partnership, excellence, ethics. And then the one we added most recently was servant leadership. So to answer your question, a true servant leader first wants to serve, and then in order to lead, you need first need to serve. So, you know, a true servant leader, it never feels like a manager, never feels like they're directing. You know, the difference between managers manage processes, leaders lead people.
Yeah.
Leaders, to us, you got to be a servant leader if you're going to succeed at DECO. And I don't think I'm the best servant leader here, but I do know I need to lead by example when it comes to servant leadership. So, you know, you sort of flip that triangle upside down. And to answer your question, never feel like, you know, I'm on top of everything. Mm-hmm. I more feel like if everybody's in a good place, the company's ultimately going to be in a good place. And what do people need to be in a good place? That sounds like sort of empty rhetoric.
No.
But a good place is emotionally, physically, mentally, and professionally. And that, you know, that means there's opportunities in front of them. Their families are good. They're secure. All those things combined to create a culture. And we're proud of, you know, we did the Great Place to Work Society. So last year we said, man, I'd love to see how we would score on that. So we reached out to them and they said, generally the way it works is, you know, we'll send you sort of the test. You can study for it for a year. We can do some polling along the way, kind of see where you would, where the company would grade out. But let's, you know, why don't we do that? And I said, if you just, what's the process? Said, well, we send it out to every one of your employees. We send out a questionnaire and they fill it out. You get a score. So I said, let's just do it. I mean, I'd rather not take a year trying to prepare for
prime
this.
The pump.
It feels sort of superficial.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, what are we really measuring if that's what we're doing?
Yeah.
So they sent it out and we graded it 95%, came back, said, great place to work. And I said, that's validation on not the leader. It's validation on everybody. It's the managers. It's the vice presidents. It's field leadership. You know, it's just the responsibility we all have. In a true servant leadership environment, the responsibility is across the it's everybody. A fitter has a responsibility to a welder.
Sure.
You know, a mentor has a responsibility to an apprentice. And, you know, when you really attack problems or opportunities in a company with that mindset, it's amazing how much input you get. Because it's not just one person telling everybody what to do. That falls apart very quickly.
Yeah, I think you make a very good, important distinction between management and leadership. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what your management skills are, but, you know,
I've never taken stock of them, to be honest with
right,
you.
Right, right. I was just going to say that, you know, but you came out of high school, you were a catcher, and you ended up in a certain destination. And then you decided to go back to school, and ultimately you came here.
Mm-hmm.
And then things transpired a certain way. I guess we could say it's just random, but I don't think that's right. I think there were some qualities that you had as a leader that allowed you to see the future.
Well, the other thing that's interesting about the catching position.
Yes.
Right. You got to be a real baseball, inside baseball sort of person. But in the catching position, there's 8 people looking in. And there's one person looking out at the team.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
Everybody else is looking in at the catcher. The catcher's looking out. The catcher, to me, was symbolically always the leader, right? Because everybody's taking their cues, body language, verbal, all those things, from the catcher. I know people say, well, the shortstop's the most important position. But to me, it's like, maybe great managers, but the leaders are. And Thurman Munson was always my guy growing up, the Yankee catcher.
Sure.
Was never the best player on the field, but always did what he had to do to lead the team, and the team was really successful. And he was the first servant leader I ever met.
It's really interesting. I hadn't ever thought of this metaphor before, but I see your point, and I also think that in some ways, if you're saying that the catcher is, in a way, the leader, the catcher's also doing it in a very subtle, nuanced way. Right?
Right.
The catcher isn't saying, I'm the leader, follow me.
And even symbolically, behind a mask.
Yes.
Behind gear.
Yeah.
Everybody else is out there for the world to see. So
interesting.
So you're right. I don't think anything's accidental. I think everything's for a reason, and there are certain cues. If you could ever predict the future, you know what to look for. But nobody could have predicted my future 30 years ago.
So as you went through the years here before you became the principal owner, and as you went through, as you mentioned, you know, there were some ups and downs in the market, in the economy. This is a business which most people would say gets buffeted by economic cycles. And listeners to Positive Enterprise Value podcast, most of whom are entrepreneurs or they want to be entrepreneurs, might hear this, and they're hearing you and me allude to the fact that you had this start, you ran the business, some things happened, and now you're going into another chapter. And they might think, boy, this guy's had a charmed life, huh? He got out of high school, he was a professional baseball player, he came out of college, mm-hmm. he fell into this position, now he's the leader of this big company. If you reflect back on the past 30 years, are there some areas that maybe weren't as successful or some things that you think of as failures that taught you a lot?
Yeah, not being the starting catcher for the New York Yankees, you know, flaming out in minor leagues.
Is that how you felt?
Not making it. Oh, yeah, that was crushing. That was because I had so much invested. That's what I was going to be.
And suddenly you had a realization that I'm not going to be.
That this is a business. You're not playing high school baseball anymore. You're in a business, and this is how the business works. And it was all in. There was no there was no sort of plan B.
So that hurt you. It hurt your heart.
Yeah.
And it was a surprise?
Yeah, I guess
it dawned on
you. In hindsight, it was not a surprise. There was, you know, I had some injury issues, and then, you know, and now when I look back, because my son went through the same stuff. So he's elite baseball player. He's working here now. But I'll just go back to where I was at. In hindsight, I absolutely should have seen it coming. You know, I had gotten sort of burnt out. I was all in, and I was in that world, and I was living that life. And then, you know, started to struggle. It's hard. It's not an easy track, and you learn pretty quickly just how good everybody is.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And I didn't mind that, like the competition of that and the pressure and the stress of that. But I just didn't like the life, and that's different. You know, I loved baseball, but I hated the baseball life. I mean, I was away from my family, my brothers and my parents, 8-9 months a year.
Yes.
A high school kid. My day after my high school graduation, I was in a Holiday Inn in Plant City, Florida.
Yeah.
Flew down on Eastern Airlines.
Yeah.
Was in Plant, and just with other high school kids, some Dominicans, some Venezuelans, college kids coming in.
All of whom were great baseball players.
All of them were great baseball players. and all of whom, some were older, some were college kids that had experience of being away from home. But now I was working in Florida the day after my high school graduation. And it was hard, and I learned a lot in a hurry. You know, you get pretty mature pretty quickly in that environment. And after a few years, I didn't like the life. I wanted to be back. I was homesick. I was all those
things. So as you had that realization, was that discouraging?
At the time, no. No.
Was it encouraging?
It was, it was what it was. I just wanted to go home.
You accepted it?
Yeah, yeah. I had sort of.
And how did you muster the energy to get on to the next chapter where you went back to school full time?
I would have to credit. So you had mentioned this guy's had a charmed life.
Yeah.
I would agree 100%. And that's loaded. Not a silver spoon kid.
Yeah.
Parents were teachers.
Yeah.
Elementary school teacher, high school teacher. We never had a ton of stuff, but we were really tight. My brothers are my best friends today. My father, my mother, we were always really close. We did what we could do. And I would 100% that upbringing was what drove me through those, I want to call them dark times.
They were dark.
It's first world problems.
Right, but
they were dark problems because I was playing professional baseball and I realized I don't want to be a baseball player.
But you committed your passion to it and your skills to it, and you tried it probably as hard as you could, and then you had a realization at some point. Oh, this isn't what I thought it was.
Well, I need a plan B.
Now
what are we going to do here?
And so what happened?
So I got home. I just felt good to hang out. I was back home. I mean, it hurt because I was no longer a baseball player, you know. And when you're back in your hometown, people ask,
"Hey, what happened?
Yeah, what are you doing here?" And
yeah.
And you have to answer that question. That's not easy.
Yeah.
But you know, I was still happy to be home. And then it was my mother that said, "Well, then you're not sitting here. What are you going to do now?" And that's when I said, "I guess I'll just finish my degree." And okay, what do you want to do? And I said, construction. I like construction management. No idea why I said that. My father used to work construction in the summer, you know, just building decks and doing that sort of stuff. No idea why I say construction, but everything for a reason, and it worked out all right.
But from an outsider's point of view, looking in, Kyle, it strikes me that as you tell that story, that somehow having that maturing realization accompanied by disappointment somehow gave you some fuel to get activated, to get onto the next thing.
Yeah.
Because you didn't wait around, you know.
Yeah.
Gee, Mom.
Yeah. Well, then I think part of it was, you know, I was home and I was answering that question, what happened? What are you doing home?
Yeah.
Those sort of things. So I wanted to get the hell out of
here. Yeah, I want to get out of here.
I want to go.
Yeah.
I'm going to go somewhere and go to school,
yeah.
And I'll figure it out there. But when I got to school and I was at Fitchburg and I was in, you know, in the construction stuff, and, you know, it just really sort of clicked in a hurry. And it might be the maturity that's required of a kid. I was a kid at that point, you know. It's just there's a certain maturation process that happens and things just strike at the right time, meet Roy Greenwald at the right time. Work at DECO at the right time, and everything for a reason.
As we think about our friends like you and think about the successes you've had, sometimes we ask ourselves, is there a characteristic that they have that's one of the driving reasons for their success? And as we look at some of our friends and clients, we can identify some of them have what we call, comes from our friend Dan Sullivan, what we call unique ability, which we define as a uniqueness that you have that you're so good at, Kyle, that when you do it, you love doing it, you get energy from it, you never get tired of doing it, and you're so good at it that when you do it, people look at you and say, oh my God, Kyle, that's fantastic. And you think to yourself, that was easy. Do you know what your unique ability is?
I do, yeah, and it comes from my father. It's the passion to see people succeed, and it makes so much sense at DECO, you know, with our own apprentice program and the people we recruit into the company to be welders and fitters and the careers they end up sharing. Three of our VPs all started through our apprentice program, and the people that we build and the careers we build around those people, not because we're a great company, but because they bring great skill and we let them do great things. Not let them. We enjoy the fact that they do great things on our behalf. But I had a conversation with a guy that runs the Pfizer site with us. You know, I was sitting around and
so
I said...
Just for clarification for the listeners, I think the Pfizer site, that's an ongoing...
It's both, yeah. But this is the ongoing presence we have there. And I reached out to the guy I was running because I had this thought hit me. It was one evening. And I said, you know, I sent this guy a text. And I said, I love the fact that you work here and you're doing as well as you're doing because my father would be proud of me because he was always fighting for guys like this person.
Yeah.
And he was he taught special ed
at
the high school level, and he didn't have and he was responsible for the Sweat Hogs. You remember Welcome Back, Connor?
Yeah.
He had the punks in that school.
Yeah.
And he was always an advocate for those kids. And they were not bad kids, but they were the Sweat Hogs.
Yeah.
And he would advocate for those kids, whether it was within the school or even afterward in a career, to get them jobs after high school and always check in on them. And he would always say, you know, these guys, nobody fights for these kids. So it was, I had this epiphany with like this one guy. And it's, there's many stories. You see the names on these panels. These are all the kids that people call losers in high school because they didn't want to go to college. They just wanted to go get a job and make good money and provide for their family. So that's sort of the passion I have to keep people like that, those experiences, and then make them VPs. Not in a year. It takes a long time. But to be an advocate with passion for those people to come in, find yourself, mature to the level you need to, on your own schedule. You know, we've had some, over 30 years, I can tell you 30,000 stories, but, you know, people that have come in, they've knocked around. And this person I reached out to, I just don't want to mention his name because I want him okay to know his name was mentioned. But, you know, he messed everything up in his own life and for us. He was laid off 4 or 5 times, fired a couple times. Every time he came back, he said, I own that. I screwed that up. He get another opportunity, another opportunity. And now he's in a leadership role.
Yeah.
He was never a bad person, just made bad decisions until he stopped. And when he stopped, he took off. And that's the place that, you know, that's sort of the culture that we wanted to grow in the ecosystem that we wanted to have at DECO, that, you know, we're going to advocate for those people and we're going to provide them opportunities and they're going to succeed on their own merits. They may not. I mean, for every success story,
there's a few.
There's some failures. Others. Yep. Yeah. And those hurt, you know. You know, construction, there's a lot of testosterone in construction. It's always,
sure,
Jimmy's late, we're going to fire Jimmy. It's like, well, you know how easy it is to fire somebody. You know how hard it is to hire somebody?
Yeah.
So why don't we, let's talk to Jimmy. I use Jimmy because there's a real life Jimmy. He was driving us field leader nuts because he was 10 to 15 to 20 minutes late every day. And finally, it was during the review cycle. And the leader said to me, we got to get rid of this guy. He's not reliable. You know, we started a day with stretch and flex, our SPAs, safe plans of action, our toolbox talks. And every time we get through everything, then Jimmy walks in. So everybody has to wait now because Jimmy's got to get up to speed. So he said, I've sent him home early. I've thrown him off the job site. He keeps coming back. And then he comes back and, you know, he's good for about a week, and then he's 20 minutes late again. So I said, have you talked to him? What's going on? Or you just keep yelling at him and throwing him out of here? He goes, no. I just, you know, I got too much to do. I sent him home. So sat down with Jimmy, said, what's going on? I mean, you know you can't be late. You've been told. It's not.
You're holding the group back.
You don't disagree with that, right? He goes, oh, no, I get it. He says, I do the best I can. I said, well, what do you mean the best you can? He says, well, you know, my mother's got Alzheimer's. She's with me. I got a baby. My wife left. I'm trying to raise this baby. My mother has good days, bad days. There's some days I just can't. I get up at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And he's driving an hour to this job site. He goes, I just can't. Yeah. You know, I'm leaving my house as soon as I can when my mother comes to take over the baby so I can then get out and get to work. I mean, his mother-in-law. And then make sure my mother's in a good place for the day. And then I get here. And he said, that's unbelievable.
Wow. So, a lot going on.
Yeah. I said, you know, called in the leader. I said, not only is 10 minutes, this guy's a hero, what he's doing. Yeah, you're ready to get rid of him. This guy should be applauded for the fact he's here at 6:15. I wouldn't have come.
Yeah.
I would have said, listen, I'm out. But he's making an effort that through conversation, you understand this guy is doing unbelievable things for the company, for his family, and for society. You know, he's not somebody we want to get rid of.
Yet he's not conforming to what the team's expectations were.
Not
so how do you as a leader?
Not for lack of effort.
So how do you align that?
We started later. I said, we're starting this job site at 6:30 now. We're not starting at 6 because we need this guy to be here. We want to support this guy. It's a half hour. If we have to start at 7, start at 7. But we're starting too early. There's a funny story.
And what's the ending of the story? So what happened to Jimmy?
Jimmy is now one of our leaders. And he has said, you know, the empathy that the company had shown one of the most loyal guys we have. It's actually fantastic to see how well he's doing. Because he said, you know, the one thing I learned through my struggles was the empathy.
Yeah.
Nobody understood what I was going through until you did. And when you did, you know, he could have said, I play Xbox till midnight. That's why I'm late. Well, guess what, Jimmy? This isn't for you. But what the story he told and the effort he showed, and he was never late after 6:30.
Right.
Cool. You know, we pushed it back half hour. And
it's a great story.
And now he's a four-person force.
That's a great story. Good work, Jimmy.
Yeah. We need more Jimmys in society than we do anybody else.
We sure
do.
I'll tell you that. Let's go back to college just for a second. Fitchburg mm-hmm. State, by the way, it's very comical. You're the second CEO, founder of a client firm who went to Fitchburg State. Also, Barbara Wilson, who is the head of Wilson Language Training, went to Fitchburg State.
Oh, is that
did
right?
you have a good experience there?
I did, yeah. I mean, I was older and... like I said, it clicked. I was a good student. I mean, I was.
You mean as opposed to a great student?
Or? Yeah. I did what I had to do to get through school, and you know, I was always in good classes and all that stuff. But you know, I was of the mind that C's get degrees, and it didn't matter anyway.
You were trying to get through.
Yeah, I was just going to be the catcher for the Yankees. So, never dumb, like never struggled with anything, but never put in a ton of effort. College, I realized. Sort of that talked about that maturation process. I put in the effort,
and it turned out differently.
It turned out, yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
So, I want to come back to my original question about chapters.
Mm-hmm.
And listeners might not know this, but so the background would be that you've just come through a capital gain transaction where the company has now been acquired by Comfort Systems. And you're running the business for now.
Mm-hmm.
Are you thinking about some changes in your lifestyle? And if so, what are they?
Yeah, not yet.
Anything fun on the horizon? Taking on new activities? New places you want to travel to? New people you want to meet?
No, just committing to getting this company and the folks here, you know, selfishly, my kids and my family members, but also everybody within the company, getting it to a really, really good place. You know, one of the reasons we did this was to have opportunities that Comfort Systems can help provide to DECO.
You mean like career opportunities?
And folks, career opportunities, yeah. And growth opportunities, and, you know, expanding the company, which I wasn't going to do. I was in a position in my career that, you know, DECO was either going to sustain itself or shrink. Limit opportunities. And
wait, could you say a little more about that? That's super interesting. Mm-hmm. So you had concluded that for you, as the you ended up accidentally as the principal owner.
Mm-hmm.
For you, the company was the right size, or when people talk to you about, hey,
no.
Kyle, we got to scale this thing.
Yeah, yeah, no. The company was, we had grown so much talent within the company that, you know, it deserved the investment to grow it. My point was, I was at the point where I was not ready to take on that risk. I didn't want to engage with banks and everything to get the capital necessary on my own behalf to take on the adventures that are now in front of us through Comfort Systems, which is growth in geography and in services and in acquisitions and all those things. This provides sort of a launching pad for us to grow into those areas that otherwise I was not going to drive the company there. I was going to run it as well as we have with the groups we have and let it sort of grow organically. But again, to answer the question, what are you going to do with this thing? That was it. It's going to keep it at the size it's at, which is one of the biggest mechanical union shop, non-union shop mechanical contractors in New England. And we were there. You know, I wasn't ready to, let's go check out North Carolina and Texas and other parts of the country. We now have that opportunity. So so that's a big, big driver for me. It was not only, you know, securing my own and my family's future, but securing the future of DECO and what that could be. Because there was just too many good people have decided to call this home to not provide them or to starve or rob them of any opportunity that is right in front of us, and we're at that position. So,
did you have some things, either activities or relationships or responsibilities, that you wanted to let go of?
No.
So you might be, Kyle, the only person I've ever spoken to, you've just described it that way, which is my words now, not yours, but my words would be, you actually were able to attract and retain and develop a team, at which I think you're describing that you saw in the team a capability that exceeded where the company currently was.
Mm-hmm.
So you felt intellectually compelled to continue to grow the company because the team had this capability that they could do more. They could go to North Carolina, they could make an acquisition, they could do whatever. But where you were internally, psychologically, maybe you weren't as aligned. If someone said, hey, Kyle, yeah, we're going to go to North Carolina, it's going to take $20 million of capital to do that,
mm-hmm.
you might have asked, of whose money?
Exactly.
Do I have that right?
Exactly. Yeah. So
So now do you get a chance to go do those things?
Yeah. So now that those opportunities are in front of us, and not only the geographical growth, but even with the within the Comfort Systems network, there's 40, 50 companies held by Comfort Systems. There's a dynamic intercompany basis.
Yes.
Offers different opportunities. For example, we're now bidding jobs where we can pull in other companies and partner with them, and now offer to our clients a whole new way to approach this job. And there's things that we do that we think is best in class that these other companies say, man, we'd love to come up there and see your workforce development program and your training program and your
other Comfort Systems owned companies.
Yeah.
Well, that's very cool.
Yeah, so, I mean, their model is really a great, great, solid one, which is, they say, we don't buy fixer-uppers.
Right.
They buy great companies. Their model is leave great companies alone to do great things, because we don't want to screw that up. And the synergy is created by holding all these great companies as they interact. 1 + 1 = 3, so... we're just starting that process. We're just starting to meet some of the other companies and having some of those conversations.
You're a young guy. Is it conceivable that you have a career ahead of you at Comfort Systems?
Yeah, I've thought about that. What does that look like
fun?
In terms of... what Comfort Systems isn't, though, is it's not a construction company that acquires other construction companies. It's truly a holding company, but it does provide resources. It does provide guidance to its network companies. When needed, they've been fantastic in, it's because they will say, we've got this great program. You don't have to use it. Keep doing what you want to do, but we've got this great program. Now, you'd be an idiot to say, you're right, that's a great program. We're not going to use it.
Yeah.
But they do it in such a low-key way. They don't force it on anybody. They say, here's what we do. I started this by saying we're so fortunate to have the right partner in Comfort Systems. We got pretty close with some private equity groups and just what that dynamic would have brought to DECO. That would have broken my heart. Not because it wouldn't have done good things for the company, but it would have changed so much of what has made DECO great. In our eyes and our version of great, because they have their own version of great, and they would say, well, we made you greater.
Sure.
Say, well, we disagree, because it cost, it costs people and it costs all these other opportunities. So fortunate that we made the choice we did, and thankful to the team at Bigelow that just guided us along the way. So,
at some points in our discussions with you over the years, and probably have our discussions gone for maybe 3 years? Something like that?
Probably 2.5 now, yeah.
Okay. There were some points where I felt like you were giving us communication that in maybe what was in your future was that you were going to transition out of the business.
Mm-hmm.
Much like you said you had tired of the life of a professional baseball player, that... I don't know that you actually said this, but what I was decoding was potentially you sort of felt like, hey, I've done this. It's been great. I'm kind of ready for the next thing and transition out of the business. Yet now when I talk to you this morning, you seem more into the business than ever.
Yeah. I don't know if that's true.
Okay.
I would say, it's a big construction business. So Some days I want to work 20 more years. Some days it's 5 more years. Some days it's 5 minutes.
Yes.
I mean, it's the nature of, maybe that's not unique to construction, but it's the nature of running a business. But, you know, through the highs and the lows, I can still say now, I love Monday morning. So, you know, until I have a clear vision of what I want to do after the business, just because why go do something else for something else's sake? Love the people here, love the work we do, love the clients we do it for. What am I looking for? You know, what else is out there? So, you know, we'll see, you know. But I do think Comfort has been such a good fit that they're starting to push. Not push, but they're starting to ask me those same questions. What else can we do? What do you think?
Because, you know, a lot of our friends and clients who are super successful entrepreneurs work in a domain where they're experts in a domain. And candidly, many of them, their domain is not transferable. Mm-hmm. And yet your unique ability, which you defined as the passion to see people succeed, and it's more than that. It's not only just the passion, but you're willing to invest in and work with people to help them get unlocked, to unlock their potential is the way I would describe
right.
it, right?
Right.
That's completely portable. Mm-hmm. So like if I were the CEO of Comfort Systems, I might be saying, hey, what can this guy do to bring that portability of that unique ability to some of our other businesses?
Right.
Because we need to unlock those people in all those businesses.
Yep.
Is that of interest?
It is, yeah.
Cool.
I think, you know, am I passionate about stainless steel pipe and welding? No. But I love the fact that the guy that's welding that stainless steel pipe and fittings was given an opportunity and now drives the nicest truck in his high school and is buying a house and is having a family.
Yeah.
That's, you know, when you really get introspective and you say, why do you do this?
Yeah.
It's why you do it.
That's cool.
So yeah, to that point, that's transportable to other industries, other businesses, to everything. I mean, I think that's why teachers become teachers. That's why there's great teachers. That's the passion they see.
So let me just take you back before we go off this topic of the business. And I might have this wrong, Kyle, to help me out. I think the business at one point was more semiconductor fab related. And I think the business, and this is the part I don't know, whether you intentionally or unintentionally pivoted the business towards biotech or and however else you would describe it. Can you just chat with us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so we came out of heavy utility mechanical piping, and then during the microelectronic, which is semiconductor and photonics.
Yes.
During that boom in New England, this is before I was the owner, we got into orbital welding. Orbital welding was the robotic or the computerized welding system to weld these process systems. During the microelectronics boom.
And what years would that have been roughly?
That's 95.
Yeah, okay.
94, 95. During the microelectronics boom, it was super clean environments, like class 10 clean rooms, class 100 clean rooms, super clean environments, super clean welding processes and systems that we developed. And then as semiconductors started to move offshore, it was going to Singapore, it was going to areas outside of America, we said, uh-oh. And we were fortunate to be in the New England area, with Cambridge being the 90210 of BioPharm.
Yeah.
BioPharm took off. Now, that clean environment doesn't necessarily translate. It is a clean environment, but it's not to the class 10s and the class 100s. It's still a clean operating environment. But in the BioPharm world, the cleanliness is more around the internal piping system and how you weld those systems. So the orbital welding required to do microelectronics translated right into doing WIFI systems and clean steam systems and BioPharm process systems. So we quickly started to develop standard operating procedures, our turnover books, which are required for the FDA to validate a piping system. It all just sort of clicked and translated very well when, you know, we met the demand of a big boom in microelectronics.
Yep.
And when that quickly started to dive, replaced it. So, you know, now BioPharm probably represents 80 to 90% of the work we do. We still do heavy utility piping, carbon steel, and those things. But our specialty niche is the biopharmaceutical.
And who led that transition?
So Roy Greenwald was the owner back then. But we used to meet. So I was running the service group at the time. It was called Special Projects Division. And, you know, I was tasked with making sure, as DECO back in that day was doing $25, $30 million single contract projects at places like Wyeth and Lonza, and then back to Wyeth and beyond. You know, that those was kind of size projects as bio started to really boom up. I was doing, through the service group, all of the microelectronics jobs. So,
yes.
So it was sort of, you know, hand in hand. We were, you know, as one was phasing out, one was booming up, and then, you know, we started to, and then the service group started to establish the relationships with the owners that were doing those big projects. So we had what we were at the time called our ongoing work agreements. We'd never wanted to leave. So we were working for places like Wyeth and for Celltech. Celltech became Lonza. Wyeth became American Home Products, became Pfizer. Genzyme became Sanofi. And we were in those facilities. So we had a construction group chasing big, big construction work. And then we had the service group, which was establishing the relationships to never leave. And now we've built the company that's got four focuses. We've got a rigging group in our critical equipment handling. Now we operate just in clean environments. That's what our CEH group does. We've got DECO Fab, which is in Brookline. They support an outside market with skids, but they also support our pipe fab in support of our construction group. And then we've got our service group. A service group does plumbing projects, does our ongoing work agreement, is our CUSP group, which is our clean utility service program. And then we've got our traditional DECO construction group, which is large projects. And those projects are, as I said, 80, 90% biopharmaceutical, but we will do heavy utility work in support of biopharmaceutical facilities as well. So we can still do the carbon steel stuff, but our specialty niche is the stainless.
So some people listening to this will hear you, and professional baseball player and student and employee and ultimately entrepreneur, not necessarily accidentally, but not necessarily on purpose. Suppose one of them or two of them are smart, driven college students and they think they want to be entrepreneurs. What advice would you give them?
It's a great question, because if somebody had asked me that question 30 years ago, I'm not sure what the answer would have been. Now it's just be passionate about what you want to do. It always goes back to that, and I think if I heard somebody say that 30 years ago, I'd say, well, that doesn't help me. What the hell does that mean? So to try to be as helpful as possible, be passionate about something and find your space within that passion. And, you know, I think when you do that, you're going to be successful. Not necessarily going to make a ton of money, right? I think, you know, my mother was one of the greatest elementary school teachers there ever was, because she was passionate about her kids and just passionate about, you know, what those folks do, teachers in general. Not all of them, but the great ones, they're passionate about it, you know. And I think that's the one piece of advice I'd give anybody asking themselves, what's next for me? What do I want to do?
You know, in a way, I hadn't thought of this until you just said it, but a way, your unique ability, which is you have a passion for helping people to succeed, is kind of the same one your mom had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I said it's very much aligned with teachers, great teachers.
Yeah.
And you know, we're fortunate, I'm fortunate, DECO's fortunate to have our school. Yeah, we've got a training school with students in it. But we can ultimately provide those students with an income and a job.
Yeah.
Teachers don't have that ability. You know, great third grade teachers, hand them off to the fourth grade teachers. We've got a combination of those things to not only teach them well and then give them a career and a job and make them vice presidents and really see them flourish. So it's like having a school with its own with its own industry to provide.
So a couple of times we acknowledged that you're on sort of the cusp of a new chapter. You're not all the way there yet. You're still thinking about it. So let's pretend we go to sleep tonight and we wake up tomorrow morning and magically it's October 18th, 2030. It's 6 years from now. What are you going to be working on?
Probably the new apprentice class coming in at TechCo. I think, you know, until I know where to channel that passion, it's going to be, because, you know, it goes so fast, too. If you had said 2040, then it gets different. But it gets farcical because it's too far out.
Yeah.
I understand sort of the time frame. But,
yeah,
you know, I just don't have a clear vision of what else. Working for a great company, you know, the folks at Comfort Systems have been so good to work with now. Deco still the Deco it always was, and you know, just the passion for me is around getting more good people into the company with great opportunities to do great things. And you know, in 2030, I'd like to be doing that as well. So
awesome.
But I will say I want to be fair to the company, because I do to Deco, because I do think there's a staleness that comes along with sort of a person that just stays there and keeps doing what it does. And I think companies need a vitality around a new vision, right or wrong, good, bad, better, worse, but just a new vision, and let it see what that does. So, you know, I would never want to get to the position where I felt like, you know, my presence was a negative.
Holding it back.
Or at least not a positive.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it's a neutral. I wouldn't even want that. You know, I'd want to make sure I'm challenged. I talked about the great folks that we have here. Somebody else in 6 years should be the CEO of Deco.
Yep.
Because we just have too many great candidates to do it.
Great.
And if I'm the one taking the seat, that's not fair to them. You know, they are going to be CEO somewhere. They should be CEOs here because of all that they've contributed. So,
a lot of group of listeners are entrepreneur owner managers. Some of them are advisors. Some of them are these wannabe entrepreneurs. I would say basically in all of them, high achievement is common. These are highly successful, highly high achieved companies. But not all of them would describe themselves as being completely fulfilled or content. Are you content?
No. No.
Say more about that.
I just think, you know, I think once you're contented, you get complacent. So I just feel like, you know, I am very proud of what we've done. I'm very proud of a lot of people within the on an individual basis of what
Jimmy and I are like this.
There's just me too, with this real sense of pride in seeing what people are doing and what they're accomplishing. And I think if you get contented, that means, okay, no more Jimmys. I'm good. We made it.
Yeah.
There's always another Jimmy.
Yeah.
There's a kid starting today. Metaphorically.
Who could be Jimmy?
Who could be Jimmy?
Right.
That needs that advocate.
Let's hope it is, because in 2030 he might be the new CEO.
Right. And if I'm content, who's going to advocate for him? Yeah, that's all. I'm certainly content in my life's sort of, you know, to overstate it, like achievement so far.
Yeah.
Family's in a great place. You know, my parent, my mother, my brothers, everybody's in a good place. My kids. So that's very rewarding, knowing that's sort of a relief, going, oof, because I think any provider has that stress. No matter what you do, there's a stress about, are the people that I love going to be taken care of? Are they in a good place? And I've gotten there. So that's, I'm content in that, but I'm never content in the work that we do.
Great.
So.
Great answer.
I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. We believe that entrepreneur owner managers are the most powerful pro-social and pro-economic force on the planet. And it's for that reason that we dedicate our firm, Bigelow, to working exclusively with them. At Positive Enterprise Value, we freely share our learning so that you can absorb from the experiences of other private business owners with skin in the game, just like you. Bigelow is widely regarded as the M&A advisor that deals exclusively with high-performing entrepreneur owner managers. Our scrappy independent boutique firm only offers one service, that is to help build and someday capture enterprise value. You can find all of the episodes on this podcast on Bigelow's website, which is BigelowLLC.com.